Dr. Martinez, welcome. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Bayer Innovators.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Absolutely. So first of all, congratulations. You were the 2025 Nobel Prize winner in physics. And this is the absolute pinnacle, in my opinion, for a scientist in so many ways. I'd like to start with your discovery, of course. And it's for discovering of macroscopic quantum tunneling and energy quantization in an electrical circuit. So quantum mechanics, in general, it's a fascinating subject in so many ways because it's so different than classical physics, than classical mechanics. And can we start by you telling us a bit about quantum mechanics? And let me give it one shot first for our audience. It's almost like the difference, right, between analog and digital, or going on a ladder versus a continuous movement. Or if you have a speedometer, you know, the older cars, they have the speedometer that shows the needle moving up and down, and now you have the digits. But there's more than that. Can you share more with us, quantum mechanics?
Sure. Quantum mechanics was invented, discovered, worked out, because people wanted to understand the physics of the small, the physics of atoms, how do atoms work, how do molecules work, you know, how light, electrons. It's a generic phenomenon of the small. And, you know, of course, this happened starting in around 1900 and, you know, went through the beginning of the 20th century, people trying to figure that out. And it was, of course, very successful, and you really had to come up with a new physics of, you know, how this worked. And, you know, for example, one can think about, if we think of an atom being a nucleus and electron, they attract each other, their opposite sign. And you might ask, well, why do atoms have finite size? If they attract, they're just going to stick together. And quantum mechanics explains why we, matter, whatever, has size, because the electron is not a point particle, but it's kind of a, you know, it's fuzzy, it's a cloud that goes around the nucleus and obeys the laws of quantum mechanics. You no longer treat something like electron strictly as a particle. It's also a wave. It has some spatial extent. And also, as you were alluding to, when it orbits around the nucleus, it only has certain energies that it could have. And this is this digital notion of this. And, you know, just to give you an idea of this, because you can see this in ordinary life, if you take an incandescent light bulb, which has a tungsten filament in it, this is, I think they're getting phased out now, but people still see those a little bit. You put a current through it, it heats it up, it gets very hot, and emits light, but it emits white light. It emits lights of every color, and that's because the electrons in the metal are vibrating at all these different frequencies and emits white light. However, if you take electricity and pass it through, say, neon gas, okay, and you look at a neon light, it has very distinct and vivid color. And that's because it's only putting out one frequency or one light frequency, one color at a time. And that's because you're exciting the atom in a certain quantum way, and it only can change its energy at a certain energy or frequency of the light, and thus you get distinct colors out of that. And it's really a phenomenon that's all around us. It's just not something we think about very often, but really is quite important. And you look at how the periodic table works, how atoms work, how molecules bind. It's all based on the laws of quantum mechanics. And they, of course, very important for us understanding how you know, matter works, how chemistry materials work around us.
Now, of course, the quantum mechanics mostly, or maybe all, applies to microscopic particles, but in your experiment, you were able to show pretty much that this happens at a macroscopic level in some ways. And I think that is the part that's fascinating. And of course, there was such a foundational work that led to discoveries and to the quantum computer. But we'll get into that later. I still want to go back to quantum. And you basically talked a little bit about superposition, which is, you know, the electrons, how they exist. But if we just think about the way, if I move my arm this way, in reality, it really is moving in steps, right? And can you explain how that happens? Because from here to here, it's actually, of course, it's at a microscopic level, but it's really just one, it moves instantaneous, right? It just moves from one.
There are two, superposition and the quantization of energy are kind of two concepts that come out of quantum mechanics. In your arm movement, think of the position of arm as a point and it moves across. But in quantum mechanically, there's some width to that position. It does move continuously across, but there's a little bit uncertainty in that. Now, for a macroscopic object like your arm, that uncertainty in the width is tiny and it's really, I don't know if you could ever measure it, it'd be very hard to measure. And you have to get into certain conditions in order to be able to do that. For one, you probably have to get it very, very cold, and you make your arm very light in order to see that width. So it's still continuous, but there's a width to the movement.
How fast does it move? Because there's no. Maybe you can talk about the atoms or other particles because the arm is too big, but there's really no intermediate position, right? It just moves from A to B without.
No. When you're moving it, you think of it as continuous, okay? And it's just that if you were to measure it at a certain time, then you wouldn't get a definite number. You'd get something a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller in terms of your coordinate. And it's kind of in the measurement that happens, that uncertainty happens. But, you know, when you think about what we call the wave function, which describes the state of the system, that has some width to it. So it's kind of funny because people sometimes get this confused. The actual movement, according to the wave function in the light, it has some width, it's very definite. It's kind of a continuous change of the wave function, but only when you measure it do you kind of get random values of it. So there's this is what enables you to build a quantum computer. The logical manipulation of the data happens perfectly and continuously and according to what's called the Schrodinger equation. But when you go measure it, then you start seeing some randomness come out of the measurements. And there's kind of two parts of quantum mechanics.
Right. So you can either have the location of the particle or the speed that it's moving at, not both, right?
That's right. Yes. And quantum mechanics says that you can't know both of them perfectly precisely at the same time. Yeah, that's correct.
Now, tell us a bit about your experiment now. How you thought about it, first of all. What triggered, you know, it's something you knew it's going to be that way, but just tell us more about that.
Yeah, this experiment was actually suggested by Professor Anthony Leggett, who sadly passed away a few months ago. And in the late 1970s, early 1980s, he was talking about this experiment. And the reason he was talking about it has to do with, let's say, the Schrodinger cat paradox, which is a standard thing that physicists learn about, which kind of describes some of the strangeness of quantum mechanics. The idea in that experiment is you have an atom that decays, and if it decays and you measure it, then you have some contraction that kills a cat. Okay, now you set up the experiment so that 50% of the time it decays, you put everything in a box, and then, you know, before you open the box, you might say, well, the Schrodinger cat is in a 50% superposition of dead and alive because you haven't measured it yet. And of course, that's very strange because it's a big object, a cat, it's living. How can this be in a superposition state? Now, there's actually, in my mind, some ways to talk about that using more standard quantum mechanics theory, but people still, it's still a strange notion. And what Anthony Leggett said is, well, maybe part of the answer to this paradox is the fact that maybe macroscopic objects can't obey quantum mechanics. And in fact, he noted that no one's ever measured that it can obey quantum mechanics because you're always looking at microscopic particles. So he suggested we should look at a macroscopic system and see if it can obey quantum mechanics, just as a fundamental test of quantum mechanics. And if it doesn't, then that would explain the paradox. And of course, if it does, that, you know, if, looking at it on the bright side, which certainly has happened, you now have this playground of new quantum systems you can build, and you can make interesting devices out of that, which actually turned out to be what happened. So with that in mind, I just thought this was the most fascinating fundamental experiment I could ever do as a graduate student. And of course, John Clark knew about it and Michel Devoret knew about it. And we talked about this and we decided, you know, this is a great experiment to do. Now, at the time, Professor Clark at UC Berkeley was looking at quantum noise effect in these superconducting devices. So he was kind of pushing into this field and knew a lot of the technology. So it was very natural to go ahead and do that. Although we did have to learn a lot and do a lot with dilution refrigerators, get an ultra low temperature. We had to learn a lot about microwave engineering and the like. It was a very natural thing to do in his lab. It just kind of, it's kind of everyone, you were thinking about quantum effects in these devices. You know, that's how we got started. Now, what I would say is looking back, I can't understand why there weren't 10 or 15 other groups doing this at the same time. It's a very fascinating question. But what's happened since then is there's this whole field of quantum information and looking at quantum systems and testing it carefully. So we were kind of at the initial thoughts of testing quantum mechanics in new ways at that time. People just had accepted quantum mechanics at that point, and the idea of testing it and using it was just beginning to come into the consciousness of people.
Right. And just to clarify, so you got the award together with John and with Michelle, and the experiment was done many years ago, but it provided this foundation that today is used into quantum.
So it was done in the mid-1980s. And I was a graduate student. I had done my first experiment and wanted to do an exciting thesis experiment. And like I say, John Clark was working on this. Michel Devoret came in as a postdoc and was very instrumental in getting started. And it was just a great team effort of us working together and figuring things out together. Because there was a lot of things that people didn't understand at the time that we had to work out to really understand, you know, what the physics of this system was.
Can you please explain a little bit about the reason why the system needs to be so cold? And I think you talk about millikelvin, you know, like a very unbelievably cold temperature, like almost absolute zero. Why is it important for the system to be at such a low temperature?
So there's an energy associated with quantum mechanics, Planck's constant times the frequency of this oscillation. And what you need to do is have the thermal energy, which is K Boltzmann times the temperature, to be less than this quantum energy, HF. And if that's the case, the thermal noise kind of smears everything out. Now, when you look at you know, light coming from an atom, that's at a very high frequency. And that means at room temperature, we can see quantum effects, like I described with the neon gas. So you can see that. But we're building a microwave device, and, you know, a macroscopic device is going to have its own characteristic energy. And it turns out you can design that microwave device to work at about 5 gigahertz or so, which, by the way, is kind of cell phone frequencies right now. At the time, 40 years ago, I mean, people knew how to do that. It was a little bit harder to do the experiments, but people knew how to do it. But if you want to work at 5 gigahertz, then you have to go to low temperature. Now, the nice thing, although it sounds like amazingly cold and the like, it's just something you can buy and make. These are called cryostats. You use liquid helium, which you have a plant to refrigerate it, and then you circulate a mixture of helium-3, an isotope of helium, and helium-4, and that can get you the very low temperature. So it's just a matter of you know, buying the right scientific instrument. Now, of course, we have the, in our case, we have to make it and get it to work properly, but it's something scientifically you can do.
So again, we'll talk more about the implications and the results of this experiment, but tell us more about what you actually measured. So we talk about macroscopic quantum tunneling, you know, as, you know, just for audience to see how much we can grasp, like what actually sure. happened, a particle moving through a circuit, through an electrical circuit.
Yeah, so in this, you have many, many electrons which condense in a superconducting state to something called Cooper pairs. But, you know, millions, millions of these Cooper pairs are flowing through an electrical wire that gives it current. And that's the macroscopicness, is that it's as many Cooper pairs, many electrons, if you think about it, that's flowing through it properly. That is the macroscopic. And in fact, the device we measured was about a centimeter across with a cross of two wires producing something called a Josephson junction. Now, the physics of this is in a superconductor, you can have current flowing without any voltage across it. And, you know, people, you're probably the superconductor you're used to is in a magnetic resonance imaging machine. It creates a magnetic field by current flowing in wires at low temperature, and it just doesn't decay. There's zero voltage, and it just stays there forever. So this is something people are a little bit familiar with. But what happens with superconductors is you can flow electricity through the wire without any dissipation until you get to too much current. And then when it's too much current, which we call the critical current, it then starts behaving like a regular wire, and you see dissipation and you see a voltage across it. And you know, then you kind of break the superconductivity. So what we did is we make a little electronic device that has a weak link purposely into it. And instead of being maybe tens or hundreds of amps, like in your magnetic resonance equipment, this has something like a millionth of an amp. So very, very small, very, very controlled. And what happens is we ramp current up through that weak link, and then we measure at which point you go from zero voltage to voltage state. Okay? And then, you know, that's the breaking of the superconductivity. Now, it turns out that you can describe that physically of a system of a potential well with a finite height. And when you get to the critical current, that finite height goes to zero, and then it escapes from this zero voltage state, and you get the voltage state. But what happens is, at high temperatures, you can escape from the zero voltage state just through a thermal process of it going over the barrier and then escaping and seeing the voltage. And then at low enough temperature, that isn't there anymore, but then the system can directly tunnel across and escape. So, you know, this is a escape from a potential surface, which is used in physics and chemistry all the time. It describes how the superconductivity works. And then we just do very careful measurements to look at how they escape is. And this, at high temperature, you can show with the measurements and with the mathematics understanding the system that it's temperature that's causing it to go over. And then at low temperatures, it should keep going down and down, but it levels off. And then it levels off in a rate that corresponds to the quantum tunneling. It actually goes through the barrier, not over the top of the barrier, it goes through the barrier.
So let's talk about the application of that. And I think you called your experiment a prehistoric bit. A prehistoric qubit.
Yes, a prehistoric qubit.
A qubit, yeah. So tell us about the application, how that becomes something that can be used in a quantum computer, basically.
Yeah, so we have to go on to the second part of the experiment that we did, and that is looking for energy level quantization. And what we do is you put on microwaves that are at the same frequency of the oscillation, which then gives it energy. It's like you tune the radio to the right frequency. You get energy from the radio waves. The qubit gets energy from that. It goes higher up in the well, and then it can escape faster. And again, this is like, the neon example that, it only oscillates at a certain frequency. So we did experiments where we put on some microwaves and swept the microwaves, and you could see at certain frequencies, then the escape out of the system went up, and we showed the existence of the energy levels. And the nice thing about the energy levels is that they can create your qubit. So the ground state, where there's the lowest amount of energy, you code that as zero. And that the first energy level, you encode that as a one. And that represents what we call the quantum bit, where the two energy levels of the quantum system are mapped to the zero and one of the quantum bit of the quantum computer. And that was shown that we had those energy levels at the time. And also, it is a very conclusive proof that you're seeing quantum behavior. I mean, that's like the smoking gun proof that you do that, because it's a subtle experiment. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. And then, from that, you can then make a quantum computer. The problem is, in the experiment we did in the 1980s, the first experiment, that one state didn't live very long. It decayed in the zero state. So the memory, it lost its memory really fast. And it's only been by many, many people working throughout the years that they figured out how it wouldn't lose its energy so fast by making the circuits very, very clever. And then you could actually start using it as a quantum bit.
So we'll talk more about that later, about the application of the quantum computer. But what is different between the qubit and the regular bit that the regular computer uses?
Sure. In a regular bit, it can be either a zero or a one. Okay. And you put those bits together, make words, you can do computation and code information in a complex way. In a quantum bit, those bits can be in superposition. So it can be at zero and one at the same time. And like I said, for the nucleus and the electron, it's like the electron can be in a cloud all around the nucleus, so it's in superposition. This is just a natural way that quantum systems want to form into these energy, what they're called energy eigenstates, these energy levels. And then you can map that to a zero and one. And then now a physical example of this I'm going to give you, it's just an analogy, but actually it's a very good analogy through something in quantum physics called the Bloch sphere, but it's a good analogy. I take my cell phone, and normally I would say a coin, but no one has coins anymore, okay? So you take your cell phone and, up would be a zero and down would be a one, and it's sitting on a table. And if it's jiggling around a little bit, there's dissipation and it stays constant as a zero or a one, unless it's too high of a temperature or something, and then it starts to work badly. In a quantum computer, you could have zero or one state, But it can be in a zero or plus one state, which we represent as it rotating by 90 degrees. And it could be mostly zero and a little bit one, or zero plus one, or all the way over. And then there's another degree of freedom called the quantum phase that it can happen. So think of it as a cell phone, floating in space. And, you know, it's just a much more complex object than a
zero or one. So the advantage of that is that it can store a lot more information, or it can somehow.
Yeah, and I'm going to say what happens is you have an enhanced instruction set. Normally with a bit, you can do nothing or flip it. You know, here we can rotate it by an arbitrary degree, okay? And, you know, you have an enhanced instruction set. For example, with a bit, you just have a knot. Here, you can have a square root of knot, which rotates at 90 degrees. And then you can also have a second square root of knot so two square root of knots is a knot, which is kind of a nice notation for it. And it's much more general than that. So because of that, because you have an enhanced instruction set to develop your algorithms, then you could take advantage of that to write new algorithms. Now, it turns out that you can, and people have done that. You can't take every classical problem and make it better with a quantum computer, okay? Only certain ones. But important ones can, and you could take advantage of that. And because of that, you can solve certain problems much faster than you can with just the classical algorithm, because you have a bigger instruction set that you can take advantage of. And nature, it's great. Nature allows us to have these instruction sets. It's a fundamental instruction set.
It's an understatement to say it's a bigger set, right? It's a lot bigger by factors of 10 to 20 or...
Well, yeah, it turns out that for certain problems, you can solve things not just a little bit better, but what's called exponentially better. What would take you, 10,000 years, you can solve in, a few minutes, okay? For certain problems.
That's amazing.
So that's what's amazing about it. Now, I just want to say it's not easy to take advantage of nature, because quantum is a little bit fragile. But that's what people are figuring out. That's why it's taken so long to do that. And then people have lots and lots of tricks to make this work right.
So again, the qubits follow the principles of quantum mechanics, right? And I think we talk about superposition, and at least more or less we kind of understood how that happens. Now, there's also this other very fascinating and very amazing property of entanglement, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Is that something that the qubit shows in any way that...
This is part of the laws of quantum mechanics, and the particular case of entanglement, Nobel Prize was awarded for that, is a particularly vivid scene of the entanglement, where you just see its unusual behavior. And what you can do is create two entangled qubits that are separated far away. And if you do a measurement of one, you know what the state of the other one is. Okay, and even though they're very far away, and you immediately know what happens on the other one. And it's kind of strange, because you would say, well, how does the information of measuring here, correlate with the measurement down here? And it's probably the wrong way to think about it. It's just that quantum mechanics kind of has a conservation law that these things always have to be connected in some kind of way. It turns out you can't send real information that way. You can communicate a random number really fast, but it doesn't violate any communication laws.
By changing,
again, it's just, yeah, go ahead.
So if you measure one qubit here and the other one that's entangled, you see the opposite. But if you make a change in this qubit, will the other one change as well?
No. Yeah, well, it depends exactly what you're doing with the change. They stay correlated, but you have to do the change in the proper way.
Amazing. Well, it almost makes me think of telepathy or ESP or some one of those things that maybe can.
Think of it as telepathy, but of random numbers or random information. So you can't communicate anything real, but you could communicate something random, which is kind of a strange notion, but it then doesn't violate your common notion of, you know, sharing information fast.
I understood you had a paper in which you discuss about the time it takes to tunnel for a particle, and then that it is not instantaneous. Can you talk about that? Is it instantaneous or is it not?
Yes, thank you very much. This is what I did for my postdoc, and it was a very beautiful extension of my thesis work, where we took all the microwave engineering and the physics we learned, and we designed an experiment to measure how long it takes to tunnel through the barrier. And unfortunately, we never published that in a big paper, so it's relatively unknown, a piece of work, but it was really a very beautiful piece of work. So the basic idea is, you know, how long, when it tunnels through, does it happen instantaneously? It doesn't happen instantaneously. And it basically takes the time for it to oscillate in the well. More precisely, if you take the well and turn it upside down, then it's the time of oscillation near the top of the well. But that's some physics, very subtle physics things. And we were able to measure that. This was something that was debated for a long time, and we were able to basically measure that. And what we did, it's a little bit technical, but we connected the Josen junction to a source of friction where we could change the time scale of the friction by actually moving a short on a transmission line. Okay, so you either have the friction acting very quickly, or then a friction acting very, very slowly. And then what happened is, the since friction affects the rate of tunneling in these systems, if it's close, then you see it affecting the tunneling rate. And if it's far away, you see it stops affecting the tunneling rate. And that's because when it's so far away, it tunnels before it has a chance to see the end of it. That's the basic idea. So you can look at the time scale of that, the time-delayed friction, and look at the tunneling rates, and you know that that's affecting the tunneling. So, you can understand that quite well.
Is that something that's being accepted, and this students learn this now in physics, or...
I unfortunately, since we didn't publish the paper in a big journal, then it's not commonly known. So I'm using the Nobel Prize lecture and whatever to talk about what was a really beautiful experiment for me, so that people know about this a little bit better. So I'm purposely talking about it, but it is an interesting concept, fundamental concept, that you want to understand. And the interesting thing is, when you talk about tunneling of particles in the nuclei or electrons through that, you can't do that experiment. But when you build a macroscopic system and you can vary the parameters and vary things because it's macroscopic, that enables you to look at this new physics. But thank you. I appreciate this because I want people to know about this experiment more.
Well, it's fascinating that, it's not so well known. So I want to...
Well, that was our fault, okay, for not publishing it. We were busy and doing many things, and that's our fault. But we can make up for it, hopefully, now.
What sparked your interest in physics?
So, ask again?
What sparked your interest in physics? Where was it, when you were a little kid, when you were in high school? When did you think that physics is going to be your career?
Okay, so You know, I was always kind of interested in math and science. My father was a fireman. He didn't have the chance, you know, growing up to go to university, whatever. But a fireman, you really have to know a lot. And he was always building things in the garage. And the way he thought about things, he always goes to first principles. He never studied physics. So sometimes the principles were a little bit, you know, squishy. But I really started thinking this way. I was always good in math and science. In fifth or sixth grade, I was able to go to a special school, a science school for, you know, a few hours a week to do that. You know, and then, you know, I was always interested in building things. In high school, I had a hobby of building electronics, for example. So, you know, I was always interested in technical things. And I took physics in my senior year and absolutely loved it. I thought it was really great. I liked where it was really built up on good concepts that follow each other. I think partly it was I had a very good high school physics teacher. You know, I liked it. One of the reasons I like physics, okay, is that I have a very poor memory, okay? And what happens is that's actually a superpower in physics, because the problem in physics is when people start memorizing formulas. And physics is really taught where you have to understand the derivation and build the concepts on each other. So because of my poor memory, I did really well in physics, because it made sense to me. And I could remember things because I could see the logical deduction. So that's what I wanted to do. When I went to Berkeley, I was thinking physics, but if that didn't work out, I would maybe do computer science, which is, of course, a really big thing. I was learning how to program. You know, in the end, I got to do both, so that was really great. But yeah, I love physics, and I did well at UC Berkeley, and I just love my classes and my teachers, and that was great. But for me, I was more of an experimentalist than a theorist. That's when my background of building things and my father's garage and, you know, doing projects. And that was very natural for me. I did fine with theory, but my real love was building things.
Well, I studied electrical engineering, and we took four physics courses in college for the degree. And I remember the last one that I always looked forward to was modern physics. And I was fascinated, yeah. And that almost made me think of going into physics. I didn't, but it was very interesting. You know, things like the twin paradox, the car in the garage paradox, all of the relativistic effects of Einstein's relativity theory. It was amazing. So I can understand why people would go into physics. It's an amazing thing. Now, what did you do after Berkeley?
And of course, a lot of modern technology is based on the modern physics, you know, electronic devices, lasers. Even you think about GPS, you have to know for GPS special and general relativity really well. So I like how all these physics concepts, which are just fundamental discoveries, have moved over into, you know, the technological realm, where you really have to understand it well to do, you know, real measurements or use real technology in the world.
There was another factor that triggered your interest in physics, right? Or especially quantum physics.
Well, I'm going to say quantum physics is something you learn about both as an undergraduate in detail and then in graduate school. That's totally fascinating. The mathematics is different and interesting. It's all students really enjoyed that, and that was the case for me. However, I first learned about quantum computing from Richard Feynman. And what happened is, for my PhD thesis, I was in Santa Barbara attending a small conference on the particular physics we talked about. But for the last talk, it was Richard Feynman who gave the talk on quantum computing. And it was, you know, kind of the highlight of the conference, really interesting. I'm going to say, you know, Feynman, I remember he was just exciting. You could tell he would just love giving a talk about this subject. What I would say is at the time, it's not like I followed everything he had to say. He's a very clear speaker, but I didn't understand everything. And I think there were some concepts that were still getting developed at the time. But the most important thing that I saw was afterwards, he was absolutely swamped by everyone in the conference asking him questions about this quantum computing. And, you know, I was just a mere graduate student. So for the ring of people, I was way out on the outside and I couldn't hear what was going on, you know. But clearly they had a really big discussion of what's going on. But what is important to take away from this is the hard part of science often is asking the right question, okay? And the question of, you know, can you build a quantum computer? What would it do and the like is just a fantastic question with, you know, lots of things to think about, lots of things to understand, which was very clear at that moment, at that seminar, that everyone had questions about exactly what was going on. And, you know, people had to work it out. It took a long time for people to work that out properly, just the basic theory and then also, you know, how you would actually go about building it. So I very much enjoyed that. And, you know, I thought it was great that people who organized that conference had the foresight to understand that, you know, these two ideas could eventually be merged.
Dr. Martinez, thank you so much for your time. Next episode, we would love to talk to you about the actual applications about the Google quantum computer and the quantum supremacy in that sense. So we'll be back.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.